We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. And we're also pleased to be talking once again this morning with Sandy Mason. She's a horticulture educator with Champaign County, University of Illinois Extension, Champaign County. And every month on Tuesday, she's here on the program, and we talk about lawn and garden care, things that grow in the home landscape. It's an opportunity to call in and ask questions. And as I say, have said many times here, you know, maybe there's something that was a problem in the last growing season, and you're just not sure how to deal with it. That's something we can talk about. Or maybe you're already thinking about the things that you would like to be planting this year. Perhaps you need a suggestion for a particular plant to go in a particular place, or, you know, whatever. You're certainly welcome to call and talk with Sandy. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And now you may email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Anyway, the question is welcome. And this morning, Sandy, I'm sorry to say she is not with me here in the studio. She's at her house.
Yes, good morning.
And I said, you know, come on, just a little bit of snow,
a little
blizzard, and, you know, and she's saying, yeah, really. Well, anyway, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure.
We appreciate it. And we do already have somebody ready to go here with a question. So we'll get to them, and that's someone on our line number one right here. Hello.
Hi, morning.
Yes.
Well, you know, it's a little hard to think about lawn care at this point, but I've been experiencing what I think I consider as lawn pattern baldness, where what I'm looking at is my lawn, sort of like, you know, as a person would go bald, they're being large spots underneath very dense clumps of grass. So what I'm seeing is large open spots, I should say. So what I'm seeing is a lawn that is the grass, I'm not sure what blend it is or what brand or type it is, but it's kind of a thin blade grass, and I've noticed that as I mow and I mulch, dead grass blades get down in between, and I'm not sure if that tends to not decompose fast enough to utilize it, you know, as a kind of a compost thing within the actual lawn. But what it seems to do is create an area under the blade surface where it is pressing down some of the blades of grass and killing them or stunting their growth. And that way, what I end up with is kind of a thin, what I consider thin hair on my lawn, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering what I can do. I've heard things about, like, you know, where you can rent a, I'm not sure what it's called, if it's a thatcher, or where you can vacuum your lawn, get all the loose stuff up underneath. Yeah. It seems like my ground is very compacted, and I just want some ideas of something I can maybe do this spring to revitalize this, you know, maybe some Rogaine for grass.
Oh, if it were that easy. So is this a new lawn or a fairly new lawn, or you've had it for a while, or you don't know how long?
We've had it for 10 years, but it's a lawn that was here, you know, probably since the house was put in. So we're talking probably 35.
Okay, so it's obviously been there. This is full sun? It's not you're not having issues with trees or shade or anything?
Well, And actually, in the full sun backyard, we're pretty good. In the front yard, we do. Our front is facing north, and so then as the sun goes overhead, we do have one large tree in the yard. As the sun goes overhead, part of the yard gets blocked by the tree, and the other part gets blocked by the front facade of the house. So, as far as shade goes, so yeah, we probably do have. We also do have some shrub issues up front too with the dryness. So, I try to water, but I don't see that as being the solution.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think probably a couple things because this is an older lawn. Probably one thing that we have found out is that some of those older Kentucky bluegrass varieties and stuff, you know, way back when there was only a couple people could choose from, and we really didn't have a lot of different varieties. And some of those older varieties, Marion and some of those, actually have some disease issues. And so over time, you find that they more and more, you know, each year they tend to not do as well. And so you often can see this sort of general thinning kind of thing. So that might be one issue. I think the other thing, it almost sounds like you might be having some thatch issues, and thatch, which Kentucky bluegrass and for the most part is one of those that just naturally produces thatch. It's that spongy layer between the grass blades and the soil itself, and that shouldn't be more than a half inch. When you start getting more than a half inch, then the grass actually starts to root right into the thatch, and then when you have drought issues or anything like that, It dries out really quick, and again, you sort of have this thinning or even death of the grass because of that. So I think one thing, once the snow goes away and the ground isn't frozen, I would just take a knife and I'd go out there and I'd cut a little plug out of the soil, out of your lawn, and look at the thatch and see if it's more than a half inch. And you'll tell. It's that spongy layer almost looks like peat moss.
Right.
And it shouldn't be more than a half inch. If it's more than that, then you got some issues with thatch. So I think probably this spring, usually April is a good time to really be thinking about that. I think of a couple different things. You may decide that there really isn't anything good left. Maybe it just really needs some major renovation, and I kind of want to start all over again. But you kind of just have to decide whether you want to, or you might do that in certain spots or whatever. But you might ultimately think about something along the lines, certainly core aerifying, which I think is kind of what you're talking about, what you were mentioned before. And it just takes out plugs of soil and sod and all that kind of stuff. And it helps the compacted soil. It also just helps the thatch issue. You know, they're called core aerifiers.
Okay.
And you can rent them, or you can have, probably better yet is maybe just have somebody do it for you, because it's not the easiest thing in the world to, the machines aren't the easiest thing in the world to handle. So sometimes maybe just getting a lawn care company and just to do that for you might be an option as well, but you can kind of decide on how much effort you want to put into that. So you might think about that. You might also think about, you can actually rent these things called slit seeders. And it's a great way to thicken up the lawn where you just feel like, well, it's halfway decent, but it's just not thick enough. The thatch isn't a huge issue. So you get these slit seeders and actually cuts a slit through the lawn and then drop seeds in. So you're basically seeding and then kind of help a little bit on the aerifying both. So it's a good way to get the seed down into the soil, which in existing lawns ends up being a big issue because it just kind of sits there on top unless you're roughing it up somehow. So you might want to just sort of decide from there and how much you really want to keep. Can I just do the split seeding in April and get some good grass seed? That's the other big part. Just get some good blends, some good mixes. It's usually Kentucky bluegrass or perennial ryegrass type mixes and blends. So just spend, you know, you kind of get what you pay for with grass seed. So you want to go ahead and spend the extra bucks and get a decent blend.
One last quick question on this, then. One thing that a friend of mine suggested is that I guess they have these things where you can literally strap spikes to your feet and aerate your lawn.
Is this a friend or an enemy?
Well, that's a good point. But I like exercise, and I'm a big guy, so I'm like 300 pounds, so I could do the stomping. You know, pretty good. The question I have is, does that actually do anything for a lawn?
It really doesn't. It's more entertaining to watch somebody do it, I think. So that's why I wonder if they're really a friend or an enemy. I think they just want to watch you do it. Because if you think about it, those spikes are really not all that terribly big. And so they're really, you know, width-wise, and so they're really not doing a whole lot to punch a hole. That's why you need these core aerifiers to take out a lot bigger core, and that's when you really see the benefit. So the other part is if you just want to, you know, have some fun and, you know, have people laugh at you, that would be a good one.
Right. I assume that you have to also know what your what mix of, like, fertilizer you're going to want to put down, too, right, for whatever graft seed you decide to put in?
Traditionally, that is probably one of the things where most of the graft-type fertilizers are usually work out pretty well. And normally, you know, if you're going to be seeding, you're not going to necessarily be fertilizing full strength at that same time. Usually, we don't fertilize until the 1st of May is what we recommend.
1st of May.
Yeah.
I'm writing this down.
Yeah, so April, and actually if you go to the Extension website, they actually have a really nice, U of I Extension's website, they have a really nice section called Long Talk, and you can go in and you can look at frequently asked questions, you can kind of get an idea. And so it's really an excellent site, and actually the New York Times a few years ago rated it as one of the best for lawns.
So when do you usually seed? Is that
Pardon?
Prior?
When do you?
Yeah, usually when do you start seeding?
Well, April is a really good time to seed.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, because Kentucky bluegrass is notoriously slow to germinate in cold soil. So this whole idea of putting the seed out on snow, I hear that a lot. It's not a good idea. Kentucky bluegrass, you know, hates cold weather. So, I mean, as far as germinating. So you're really better off. Wait till April. Soil temperatures have risen. Get halfway decent days, we hope, and it'll germinate faster, and that's really what you want.
All right. Well, thank you. I have just one thing I want to say. People who do not compost are not benefiting. That's just the thing I think. It's a statement I'm trying to make as often as possible to as many people as possible. People to compost and grow your garden through your compost, because I really do a great job with that.
Yeah, oh yeah, compost is great stuff.
All right. And it's free, and it's a great thing, and it's not really complicated. Maybe people think, oh gosh, I need some kind of special equipment, or there's some. It's really difficult. You know, maybe you need to know a couple of basic things, but it's not that difficult.
Yeah, as we say, compost happens. So.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Sandy Mason. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County, and once a month on a Tuesday is here. We talk about lawn and garden care, and she's with us by phone this time around, but it's the same sort of thing. If you have questions, she will see if she can help you out. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and also you can email the question to will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's somebody else to talk, and Champagne, line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a brief question. We brought two hanging ferns in off the front porch before it froze, and they're not doing so well inside this winter. The inside center portion seems to be growing green shoots, but the outside portions keep dying despite regular watering and seeding. Any advice, please?
Yeah, these are like Boston ferns or some of those kind of traditional hanging basket type ferns.
Correct.
Is that probably what these are? I think probably the biggest thing, ferns have a tendency to grow out to the edge of the pot. I mean, completely grow out to the edge of the pot. And so sometimes, especially indoors, it's hard to keep them watered. So I guess I'd wonder a little bit about that, because often they get so full that the water just kind of rolls off or rolls off to the side and they never truly get wet. So I kind of wonder about that. You might look at the pot and see if the fern is basically taking over the whole pot, and there really isn't any good place for the water to go through and properly get them moist. So that would be one thing. So what you might think about doing is maybe going ahead and repotting them. And you can do some, you know, pretty major cuts on these, and it seems like the outside edge doesn't seem to be growing or might even be dead at this point. Just cut that off. Just take a, you know, serrated knife, just cut that off, and, you know, keep the good section, you know, repot it, and then I think you'll find it's easier to water, easier to keep them moist, and it'll end up doing much better for you.
Great. Thank you. We'll give it a haircut.
All right. Frank, on to, again, to another caller. This is also somebody in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, I just want to add to your answer to the first question about lawns here. I would warn anyone against using those 9-inch spike heel things, sandals, to walk around their lawn. I have tried that, and yes, you can puncture into the lawn very nicely. But what you can't do very well is pull it out again, because if you pull up one foot, the other foot goes down.
And after a few steps,
you get the feeling, you know, I could get stuck out here and become living statuary. And moreover, I will guarantee if you do any, like 10 minutes of that, the next couple of days you will have permanent Charlie horses and you'll just cripple yourself. So please stay away from them.
I hadn't thought about that avenue. But another way, you know, that people can, you know, laugh and enjoy your pain.
Yes.
Well, thank you.
We all like to do that, don't we?
Thank you. And then the neighbors are going to be putting you on YouTube.
Yeah, really.
And then the whole country will be watching you. So don't do that. Yeah, exactly. Questions here. Welcome. You'd like to talk with Sandy Mason, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I guess I'm just thinking, certainly we've talked about this before, about the caller at the issue with the fern, that people do, and, you know, maybe this is a little late now. It's probably been inside for some time. But when people bring something in from outside, they have to bear in mind that there's a big difference in the light level between the inside and the outside. So you want to find the sunniest place that you can to put the plant. And then, you know, we all have problems with dry skin in the wintertime. Well, it's because the indoor air is dry. So it's a big difference. And some plants, you know, they don't take well to hot, you know, to being inside the house when it's hot and dry.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And also with the gentleman with the fern, it's the same kind of thing. Ferns hate that. They hate the dry air that we have. So that's a good point. And most of the ferns that we're going to have are highlight plants, so they're going to need that extra light too. So, you know, we get these dreary days where it's just day after day after day of no direct sun. It's probably a really good idea to get some sort of supplemental lighting, some fluorescent lights. And now with the small bulbs and stuff, it's real easy to get some fluorescent light, I think, extra light on your plants. And I think that's just generally a good idea. And so when we start getting into March, it's not so much of an issue. But certainly now, January and February, one of the tough months for that kind of thing.
Well, and if you're going to do that, do you need to have some kind of bulb that specially says that that's what it's for? How much attention do you have to pay to what kind of, you know, what the spectrum of light that the light's putting out is?
Yeah, and it is one of those things. You can buy grow lights or grow bulbs, which do give a little bit better wavelength, the amount of wavelength that's given off, and actually this better spectrum of light. But for most of us, we're just trying to get the plants through the winter, and so we're not being competitive gardeners so much as we just want them to survive. So I think just plain old, you know, now with these complex fluorescents and, you know, just anything along those lines is great. You don't have to leave it on the whole time. Even if you can, usually we say about 16 hours is good, so you can put them on a timer or whatever, but it's really a good thing to sort of get into. And certainly if you're going to start seedlings indoors, you're going to need some fluorescent light. So I personally don't think it's worth it, that extra money that's spent on grow lights, but if someone really feels like they want to go that route, I think that it does get better light. So you kind of have to decide on how competitive you are, I guess.
Well, again, other questions here are welcome. Sandy Mason is with us. She's with us once a month on the show. It's always on a Tuesday to answer questions about things that grow in the home landscape. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. And also the email is will-talk@illinois.edu. I was thinking about how, you know, as I was walking in this morning and walking along through the snow, this being a pretty wintry winter, it's almost hard to imagine that the stuff is all under there and it's all sleeping, and one of these days it's going to wake up. And it also strikes me that, you know, when the growing season is going, you're busy and you're trying to take care of all kinds of various things. You're trying to take care of the stuff that's there. The time to be planning and thinking about what you want to do is now.
Yeah,
now is the time. And of course, dedicated gardeners do that. They spend their winter looking at books and looking at catalogs and trying to, you know, thinking about what it is they want to do. I think for a lot of the rest of us, we don't get around to it until suddenly there are plants in the garden centers and we start thinking, well, maybe I should buy some stuff. It doesn't hurt to start thinking about that now, particularly if you're, you know, maybe you have some particular place you want to put something, to think about what you would like there, what you want it to look like, what the conditions are, and start to make a list of possible things that you might want to put there, rather than just, you know, then when it's when the plants are there in the store, you go there and, you know, you see what's there and you think, well, maybe this will do.
Yeah, really. Oh, that's pretty.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's fine, you know, to do that. But, you know, maybe sometimes you'd do better if you actually thought about it a little bit and tried to do a little planning ahead.
Yeah, I think so. Especially, I think if people were to sort of think about those things that maybe they had problems with last year, where that shrub was just too big and you really need to make a decision now on, is it something I'm just going to, you know, rip out and start all over again, or do a little research, is it something I can actually prune back and then it won't be quite so big. So I think if people at least start with those areas or those plants maybe they had problems with, and then make that decision on whether I'm going to keep it or I'm going to try something different or something along those lines. And, you know, a lot of that is maintenance, you know, ends up being maintenance issues. Mm-hmm. And sort of trying to take care of those maintenance issues now by thinking through, you know, maybe that's just a plant that gets so many problems or it's way too big for that site or whatever, and just sort of think through on what I can do about those sites. I think people would go a long way later on and find that, you know, spending that extra effort in the spring to take care of those problems, they'll enjoy it for years to come.
Yeah, okay. Well, questions, again, are welcome. We have someone here ready to go in Champaign. We'll talk with them. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm going to be planting a butterfly garden this summer, and I wondered if you had any, or spring rather, have any extra tips for me. I have some milkweed seeds, and I need a little more information on what I can do about how to plant them and what areas they need to be in.
Sure. Well, I think the good news is there's lots of information out there in butterfly gardens, from books to, you know, websites, you name it. You can go and find all kinds of information about that. So that's the good news. It's out there. I think one of the things to look for is, you know, what kind of butterflies might you expect in your area? And, you know, that's probably one of the big things, and really thinking through, you know, to make sure that you have those plants. And from, you know, usually when we think about a butterfly garden, the one thing we do have to think about is the fact that, you know, butterflies, you know, they kind of start out as caterpillars, and caterpillars eat things. So they eat plants, and so you kind of have to decide, you know, am I going to be able to tolerate that? Is that okay? I mean, hopefully it is, and people feel like they want to continue that, but just to realize that's part of the whole cycle, is that you have to have those plants that the caterpillars will eat, and then in order to be eventually become butterflies. So finding out what kind of butterflies you might have. And so for us, you know, we certainly get monarchs. A lot of swallowtails come through. Actually, the Illinois Natural History Survey really has a nice book on butterflies of Illinois, if you really want to get into it, which is really a great book, and it'll actually tell you what plants those particular butterflies will eat. So thinking about, or the caterpillars will eat, to make sure that you have those in there in order to get the butterflies. So kind of think it through the whole cycle rather than just having nectar plants, which is still good. We like to have butterfly bushes and some of those that butterflies can nectar off of. But it's nice to, you know, continue that cycle. They're full sun, you know, full sun plants, full sun animals for the most part. So you need to have those full sun areas. They don't like a lot of wind. They're not particularly good flyers. So if you can actually somehow have kind of a windbreak area for them, so maybe having some shrubs nearby that will help with the wind, and also just a place for them to hang out.
And you can't fix it so that the caterpillars will eat the plants in your neighbor's yard, and then,
you know,
the butterflies will come over
that
to your yard.
You kind of just have to decide this is part of it. So the nice thing is things like dill, the swallowtail caterpillars often eat a lot of the plants in that dill family. But the nice thing, you know, dill, you can plant a ton of dill, have plenty for you, plenty for the caterpillar, everybody's happy. So just thinking through a little bit that maybe I can have a little extra for them as well as for me. But, yeah, it is one of those things you kind of, as a gardener, we kind of have to change our mindset a little bit when it comes to caterpillars eating things.
Okay. And you said it was the Illinois Natural History Survey has a nice book?
Yes, they have a very nice book. It actually is Butterflies of Illinois, and it's a really beautiful book and, you know, some great pictures, but it gives you lots of information, and it'll actually show the different counties of Illinois and what butterflies you can check and see, is that a butterfly that's often seen in my county? And that's really good. They actually have one also on silk moths, if you're into the big moths. And so they really have some great information out there on
okay.
on identification as well as
That's one of the surveys that's based on the campus. I'm sure that they have a website that if people can get, if they just put in Illinois Natural History Survey in their browser, I'm sure they can find the site. And I would bet that they would have publication information on their site and people can go
from there. Yes, you can certainly contact them to get publications. So they have a great listing of publications.
Okay. Let's talk with someone in Bloomington. Line 4.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have blue spruce groupings, plantings in my yard, and I have been battling bagworms the past several years. Basically, I pick them off and then destroy them, burn them, whatever. But this last year, I just had a total influx on the trees to where some of the branches are actually even defoliated. I wondered what approach I should take chemically or mechanically to get rid of them.
Yeah, well, you've hit upon the one thing is actually, you know, pick, you know, this, well, I don't know if today is a particularly good day, but, you know, certainly during the, you know, the dormant season stuff, you know, picking them off. So trying to pick off as many as you can, because unfortunately one bag, one female bag, can produce hundreds of little bagworms. So even just leaving one on is an issue. So I know it's kind of tough sometimes when they get really high in the trees. So I know sometimes that is a major issue. And and believe me, I've had my own issues with my trees, and it's easy to miss them. You know, you think you've got them all, and next thing you know, there's a couple there that you didn't see. So I think that's one thing, trying to pick off as many as you can, destroying them, as you mentioned. And then also, you know, you may want to think about, usually we think of mid-June to the end of June, you actually can do some spraying. The nice thing is you can use some of the bacterial products, so BT. So it'd be, they're sold as Caterpillar Attack or Thuricide, or there's any number of those. And the nice thing is it's really very specific on caterpillars and mainly bagworms that are going to be on spruce trees like that. So it's very specific and has a low toxicity and all those good things that we like to have. So that would be one thing. But you have to write on your calendar, because at that point the bagworms are tiny, 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 tiny little caterpillars, and you won't notice the caterpillars are so little at that stage, but that's the best stage to kill them off. So usually, depending on what our spring is, probably spray in mid-June and then certainly again in the end of June, and then kind of keep an eye out after that.
And do you just cover all the foliage on the tree?
Yeah, unfortunately, and I know with big trees that's really tough. I know that's really tough.
And you said the name of that product was Cat Attack or Thuricide?
Well, there's it's actually a B as in boy, T as in Tom, BT, and it's sold as Dipel, Thuricide, Caterpillar Attack. But usually if you can go into a garden center and ask them, you know, I have bagworms, what could I use? And usually this would be the thing that would come to mind for them.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, right. Good luck.
There
it's a tough issue.
We are just about at a midpoint, maybe a tiny bit past. This morning, our guest is Sandy Mason. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. Once a month on a Tuesday, she's with us on the program. We talk about lawn and garden care. She usually is here in studio with us, and we're always happy to see her. But this morning, she's at her house. But same deal as always. We're taking your questions on plants, something from problem from last year, something you're thinking about for this year, things that grow in the home, landscape, trees, shrubs, flowers, grass, stuff you can eat. We can take those questions. If you have houseplant questions, we can take those too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we'll go on. And let's see. The next person we'll talk to is in Urbana. And line 2. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a question about dahlias. Last year I bought some and had them blooming in the garden. And I saved the tubers over the winter. I've got them in peat moss. So I would like this year I would like to start them indoors, in pretty good-sized pots. When would be a good time to plant those if I want to start them inside?
Yeah, usually you probably think at least, you know, dahlias are a great one to keep because that tuber fruit actually get bigger every year, and so you actually have a better flower period and certainly better flowers at that time. So usually we think at least a month before you might put them out. So I would say at least by April 1st I'd be thinking about that, because dahlias are, you know, they're subtropical types of plants, and so they don't like it unless it's warm. So usually we probably wouldn't put them outside till mid-May.
Okay.
So that should give them plenty of opportunity. You don't want to start them too early, because then if they get too big, what are you going to do? You know, what are you going to do with them unless you've got a greenhouse or something?
So you're saying the 1st of April would be good.
Yes, to go ahead and pot them up. And then hopefully by then there'd be, again, you might be in the issue where you might want to add a little supplemental light with fluorescent lights, but, you know, at least at that point.
I would put them under fluorescent lights.
You are going to, you said?
Yes.
And so that's great if you can, and you really want to grow them, you know, fairly warm. So we're talking about, you know, probably around 70, 72 degrees.
Okay.
So you want a warm spot, plenty of light, and then kind of get them going at that point, and then they'll really take off once you put them out in the garden.
And when do you first fertilize them?
Pardon?
When do you first fertilize?
When do you first fertilize them? Mm-hmm. I think what you could do, you might go ahead and fertilize them, you know, once they first start to pop out, but you don't want to promote too much growth at that point, because they end up being too big. So then I probably wouldn't fertilize them again until I actually get them out in the garden.
And you just use a potting soil?
Yeah, I just use a really good, well-drained potting soil, or even some of the container-type soils that are soilless mixes are good, because they're one of those that they like it moist, but they don't like it too wet.
Okay.
But they really are one of those. And what you may find, I don't know, when you dug them up, you found that you have multiple roots coming off?
I did.
Yeah, you actually can divide those.
Oh,
so
you can.
They almost look like little sweet potatoes then, but you can actually divide those if you want to and have multiple plants.
Wow. Well, so how many tubers would you leave on one clump?
You can just leave one.
I'm sorry?
You can just leave one.
Just one?
Yeah, you can actually divide, unless they're like really small, then you might leave a couple together, I suppose. But actually you can, you know, each one of those will go ahead and sprout.
I mean, when I buried them, there were at least five or six, you know, tubers.
Well, you know, again, that's up to you on how you want to do it. You can literally divide them one apiece if you want.
So you just cut them.
If you want bigger plants, you certainly can.
You just cut them with a sharp knife.
Yeah, they come off really pretty easily. They're not, they're not well attached. And that's, you know, division on any kind of plants. You know, it's really up to you on how big. If you want a bigger clump, then you leave more on. You know, sometimes the clump's so big it's hard to find a pot big enough. You know, those kind of things.
Yes,
you kind of
yes.
have to go through it from there, but.
Okay, thanks for the information.
Very good, thank you. That just maybe it leads to a kind of a general question about how you know what you can divide and what you can't.
Yeah.
Because there actually are a lot of things that you can divide, but you should make sure that you know, is this something that I can chop in half and the two pieces will just go on and say, that's fine with us, we'll just go on and make, we'll just go on, and other things that would not be real happy if you did that too.
Yeah, I think probably a lot of it is just sometimes when you get used to, you know, digging things up, you can usually see, even you know, in dormant season or whatever, you can usually pull them up, even peonies and stuff that are dormant, they'll still have these little, like, you know, they call them eyes, but to me they look like little noses, and a lot of plants have those, and those will be the stems for next year or the next season or whatever it is. And so usually you can tell, even when the plant's dormant, you know, whether this is something you're going to be able to divide, you know, just looking at those eyes or noses on there to make sure that you have at least, usually we say a couple of those at least, depending on what the plant is, so that you have stems for the next year. If you're not seeing any little nubs or noses or eyes or anything like that, I'd be a little bit more concerned about trying to divide things. So looking for those growing points, I think, makes a big difference. And there are a few plants that are just really tough to divide, things like bleeding heart and maybe Baptisia, the indigos. You know, so there are definitely some that you'll read about that said, it's kind of tough to divide them.
Okay. We have some other folks here to talk with, and we'll go on to Mattoon, line 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
This fall, early October, I think it was the second week, I planted two rows of garlic, raised rows, and normally I would cover them with leaves. But this year I used some commercial mulch and covered them, and they poked through before too long. And I'm just curious now this spring, I'm not really familiar using that much mulch on them and on raised rows. In the past, when they grew, in late spring, I'd fertilize them again. Usually pull some of the leaves off and put fertilizer on it. What should I do this spring with the mulch? Just leave them alone and...
So this is like a wood chip mulch that you...
Yes.
Okay, okay. So it sounds like maybe a little heavier mulch than you typically have used, maybe.
Yeah, it is fairly... It was heavier than the leaves.
Yeah, yeah. I think once we start... Once things start warming up, like certainly in, you know, in the next month, March or so, I'd start pulling things back a little bit and start looking and seeing what's going on. I think probably with the wood chip mulch, you'd be better off to pull some of that back as things warm up. When it's real heavy like that, because they actually can rot. You know, some of the, especially onions and garlic and some of those things can actually rot if they're too wet. You kind of want them a little bit on the drier side. So I'd be a little bit concerned because of the wood chip mulch, because of doing that. But
well, I thought about that, and they did poke through, though.
Yeah, and they should be fine. I think just leaving it on there, especially when we have wet springs, as we often do, I'd be a little bit more concerned about them just getting too wet. So I think I'd start pulling, you know, start pulling the mulch back a little bit. And,
in April? You
know. Pardon?
March or April?
Yeah, I think March. Hopefully, when things start warming up in March, I'd start pulling them back a little bit because they'll start.
Throw a little fertilizer on it at that time.
Yeah, once they obviously start growing, then you certainly can fertilize them at that time.
Okay, thank you.
All right, very good. And again, to another caller here, Paxton, line 4. Hello.
Yes.
Yes.
I am going into my 12th or 13th year of my wisteria not blooming.
Oh, man.
I know. And I call everybody. I called the plant experts last summer, and they told me to try something drastic, root prune in the fall, taking my spade and poking it down. But I didn't get to that this fall. Would you recommend that this spring?
You know what I would recommend?
What?
Because I am with you. I've been there.
Yeah.
I think mine was certainly 10 years old, if not 12 years old, and not blooming.
Uh-huh.
And you know what I did, and it was the best thing I ever did? I dug it up and got rid of it.
Oh.
And got a new one.
Well, I did buy a new one because yes. I've got three together, and they make kind of a screen on the south side of my back door. And so I have hopes for the new one I bought because it was blooming.
It
had bloomed.
Right? Yeah. See, I think you're, for some reason, some of the wisteria is because I've talked to so many people that were on the same thing. And believe me, I tried everything. Everybody
mm-hmm.
told me. Root pruning
mm-hmm.
it back, you know, all this stuff, stressing it, talking bad to it, all that kind of stuff, and it never bloomed. So I just decided, you're out of here. And I bought some of the newer varieties. That Amethyst Falls is a really nice one. And these are actually hybrids of the native wisterias. And so I just think they're just better. They're just better with our particular climate and weather and just everything. And I think the fact that you can buy them in flower, you know that they're already flowering.
Yes.
So my feeling, unless you truly feel like you want to try one more year with this thing, I would really think about just replacing it with.
Okay, but I could. I mean, I could do that in the spring. Root prune.
Yes.
Okay.
You certainly could root prune it and try it, but it, you know. That would be one more thing.
All right. Either that or just enjoy the leaves because it does make a nice
absolutely. Green. And it does. You're absolutely right. But I have certainly heard that with root pruning, you certainly can do that and just pruning it back and all those good things.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right.
Good luck.
And very good. Thank you. And we'll go on next to someone in, I think, in Champaign here, line 1. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Two things. One is I want to comment on the wisteria thing. Don't rip it out. It only blooms on horizontal wood. I had a beautiful one in New Jersey, which used to run along the ground and be horrible and just show up everywhere. I pruned it with a chainsaw to two pieces of wood, tied it absolutely horizontally, and it bloomed like crazy. It only blooms on horizontal wood, and you do have to beat the daylights out of it. That's my take on wisteria, and it's true. Everyone in the world has a different take on it. But I did manage to get a really old one to bloom that way. The question I have is, I have a New Dawn rose on the front of my house, which got kind of frozen a few years back with that late spring frost. Mm. It's now making tons of wood again, but it doesn't bloom very much anymore. And I'm wondering if there's any kind of a hard, since it blooms only once early, if I prune the living daylights out of it, will it make lots of new wood for blooming, or is it just toast because of that frost?
Well, I think for a lot of them, that late frost we had in April, what was it, 2 years ago?
Yeah, it was horrible.
Yeah, it was horrible, and the roses got hit really hard, and I think they still needed a year to recover.
Uh-huh.
So I was thinking that for a lot of them, now mine started to recover last year, and they were looking much better, but I think they got hit so hard it's taking them a while to get to recover.
So just do the hard early prune and hope for the best, and if it doesn't, I shovel prune at the end of the season.
Yeah, I think just doing it, and especially if you're getting, I don't know if you're getting a lot, sometimes they put out a lot of little twiggy stuff that doesn't really amount to much anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, actually removing some of that and getting rid of some of those kind of almost, they almost look like suckers sometimes come up from the bottom. And that really weak-wooded stuff, kind of get rid of that and try to encourage better growth on the rest of it, I think is a good idea too, really on all the roses for the most part.
Okay, and the last question is bunnies. Anybody got any good? I planted a whole lot of Griffith Bucks roses last spring in a new bed. The bunnies mowed it down constantly. I lost a few of them just because they mowed them to the ground. And I'm not really used to the bunnies doing the roses so badly. If I plant garlic, does that work? I mean, I've tried pea. I've tried every other kind of awful thing you can think of, and it seems to not deter them at all.
Yeah, roses are actually one of their favorites. I know they have lots of favorites, but roses are actually one of the all-time favorites, especially young ones. What I've noticed is if I can get them through a couple of years and the roses are bigger, they don't pick on, they pick on them a little bit, but they don't pick on them nearly as much as they are when you're young. So I generally always use chicken wire or some other
cage
thing around the young ones, and you know, get them through a couple of years, and then I don't have to worry about it. But so I think that's one of the all-time best ways, because then you know it's going to protect them. But I've had actually pretty good luck with some of the repellents.
Uh-huh.
Liquid Fence, I don't know if you've ever tried that particular product.
I tried it. It worked for a few days, and then, you know, I'd miss it by a week or whatever, and it was, you know, they'd have a fiesta one day and everything would be back to square one.
Yeah, I've had pretty good luck, but I had, you know, you have to use it exactly like they say, as in actually make a fence with the product.
Yeah.
And then spray the individual plants, and at least for me, that one helped. So, but the repellent, you know, if they're hungry enough, they'll eat through the repellent. That's why the fencing and stuff. So sometimes I think, at least what I've found is with rabbits, they always pick on whatever's new. You know, new shrubs, new plants, whatever's new, that's what they pick on.
Yeah.
So just knowing that in the beginning, and just figure, okay, I'm just going to have to, you know, fence these guys in till they're, you know, bigger, and then I can.
I'll have to resort to chicken wire. I hate the stuff, but okay.
I know. But, you know, spray paint a little bit green or something. I don't know. I know it's hard, but it is. I always say it looks like my plants are under house arrest because they all got cages around.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks you very much. I think lead would be a good deterrent.
You know, bunnies are really hard, and I've noticed just, you know, especially now when they have, you know, little to eat, they're going to start picking on things like roses and any of the fruit crop, you know, raspberries, blueberries, new shrubs. You know, even now people may have to really, you know, look at their landscape, and maybe they find they have to do something now about it.
And I think, though, what you say is absolutely true. I think that the things that are the most vulnerable and the most attractive are the things that are the most tender. Once stuff gets established, then it doesn't seem to be much of an issue. But I think what you say, really, what you have to do is, if you have something you fear is going to be susceptible, or something that you've just planted, or, you know, some kind of perennial that sends up these nice tender shoots in the spring, you have to put up a physical barrier. I kind of think that's really the only way. You just have to make sure that the rabbits cannot get at the plant.
Yeah. And actually, if their plants are young enough, I've actually had pretty good success with those wire baskets like you get for, you know, for closets or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I just take those, and I usually try and spray paint them green or something so they're not quite so obnoxious. And then it's real easy for me to put them on there. So I just sort of flip them over there right after I plant the plant and, you know, leave them on for a while until hopefully the rabbits somewhere else.
Yeah. I got a question, an email question here I want to get in. I don't know if you can, this is one of those diagnose over the phone questions we always say the doctors can't do, so we see how you can do. We have someone listening here who says that she has a row of boxwood shrubs. Last summer she noticed a lot of spider web looking fuzz on some of them, and now she says there are many dead patches, which she said means dead brown leaves and stems on the shrubs, and she wants to know, well, what do you think that sounds like, and what could she do?
Yeah, I don't know with boxwood whether they actually get powdery mildew. I mean, it almost sounds like powdery mildew, but I don't know if boxwoods actually get powdery mildew. So it might be a fungal issue. We might actually be seeing two different things, too, because boxwoods will certainly, because they're broadleaf evergreens, certainly suffer from, you know, if it's wind or cold or all those kinds of things. They don't like it particularly wet. So sometimes we get dieback on those just because of environmental kinds of issues. So we might be actually seeing two different things. So I'm not sure that one necessarily means the other. So, but probably the ultimate thing is just what you were saying, is that when these things start to happen, if people can either bring them over to us or take them to the U of I plant clinic through the gardening season, then we can get an accurate identification and kind of
right.
go from there. I think at this point probably the best thing is that when they get a chance is just to cut off that dead stuff and then kind of reevaluate it and see if it happens again.
But then, as you say, when things are really going, if there's an ongoing problem where you can bring a sample,
right.
where you can clip off a piece and get someone to actually be able to look at it, then there's a better chance that they're going to be able to say, okay, I can tell you what this is and then tell you what to do about it. Because depending on, you know, the cure or the treatment might be really different depending on what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually last year we saw a couple of different insect problems on boxwoods that we typically hadn't seen. So I think that's, you know, sometimes actually things kind of show up, these symptoms show up, and it actually might be an insect or it might be a fungi or something along those lines. But And sooner the better. That's the big thing. You know, it's just fine. You know, looking at things early, getting accurate identification early when you still have a chance to do something about it, I think is good.
Right. We have a couple minutes left here. Sandy Mason is our guest. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. Once a month on a Tuesday, she is here to answer questions about things that grow in the home landscape. So, again, it could be trees, shrubs, could be grass, could be ornamentals, could be food crops. Also, we can talk about houseplants as well. Any and all that, certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. You may also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Something, you know, I know that probably there are some people who do bulb forcing or buy bulbs that are ready to be forced so that you can have a little something inside, a little something green and growing and in the springtime before things really get going outside. One thing that I think is pretty cool, and I don't know how many people have done this, is if they have woody plants that flower, say like a forsythia or a redbud, or there are a number of things, if you could sacrifice a couple of branches, you can actually force them into bud as well. And I'm just wondering, is there, aside from those things that I mentioned, is there anything else that you think, well, yeah, actually you could do that, and if you don't mind clipping off a piece, you can, that's actually kind of fun, and it brings a little bit of early spring into the house.
Yeah, oh, I think that's a great idea. And usually most of our shrubs could probably use a little pruning now and then anyway, so I think that's good. So any of the early flowering things from crab apples, you know, those are always a really good one to, you know, forsythia, as you mentioned. Lilacs are a little bit harder to force. That big flower that they have is a little harder to force and usually takes a little bit longer. So that one may be a little bit harder for some folks, but any of them with the smaller flowers, you know, even apple trees or, you know, some of the fruit-type trees you may find you want to go ahead and bring a few in because you needed to do some pruning on them anyway. And I actually just like seeing the green leaves popping out. There's just something that makes, even if they don't flower. And usually you can tell the flower buds on the stems at this point because they're generally, the buds are bigger. So you want to, if you do want the flowers, just make sure you get a branch or a stem that has some small buds on it, but then some particularly large buds, and then you know that you more than likely have some flower buds on that particular, those particular stems. And just bring them in, you know, cut them off, you know, make sure they have a nice good cut. Keep them in water just like you would with a cut flower. And usually, you know, it'll take a week or two for some of them to go ahead and flower, but it's, you know, it is nice. And
yeah.
It's a great way. Cheaper than therapy, I guess, huh?
a heck of a lot cheaper. And is it too early to do that now?
No, actually you could. For most of the plants, they've already gotten enough of a cold period that they will go ahead and force. So it's fine. So usually by the time, certainly by the time we get into the 1st of March or so, they're ready to go. So usually mid-February, end of February is just fine. So that's
okay.
The timing.
All right, very good. Let's go to the phones again. And we have a caller here, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi, you were talking about forcing, and I have a couple of volunteer cherries in my yard.
Oh.
Is it okay to go ahead and do, I mean, I would think that they're pretty hardy. You could do that to them too, right?
To go ahead and bring them in?
Yeah, I mean, just cut off a branch and...
Sure. I think, you know, because they're volunteers, I don't know how big these are. They may or may not have flowerbeds on them.
Yeah. My question is, I have... my husband's from Alabama, and his father every year gives us cuttings of camellias, which are still blooming down there when we're, you know, we're dormant. And I just couldn't bring myself to throw the greenery away. And so I have them in water, and I'm noticing that, you know, they're starting to sprout new leaves. So I'm kind of, it's kind of along the line of what you just talked about in terms of, you know, making them, can you make them into plants that you could put in your garden, or would they not do well here in this climate?
Well, it's going to be a little hard. You know, it'd be something you obviously have to bring in every winter, but you certainly could try and grow them on and as a, you know, as a house plant and then certainly once it gets warm, like after mid-May, to go ahead and put them outside. I don't know how well those things root. Are they starting to show any roots or anything?
Not much, no.
It'd be one of those things. I'm not that familiar with camellias on how to start them from cuttings like that, but I'm sure if you go to the web or go to the library and get a propagation book, they can give you an idea. And often a lot of those things will go ahead and start from cuttings.
Okay.
And so it might be, you know, well worth it.
So you're saying I could maybe, if the, you know, if my information gets is encouraging, I could maybe put them in large pots and then bring them in.
Yeah, it would be one of those things where you just have to bring them in every winter.
Okay. Great. I'm glad you're calling from home. I'm glad you didn't try to come in, Sandy.
All right. Thanks
for
the call.
Thanks again.
One more. I think maybe this is Urbana, a line two. Hello.
Hi, this is Mohammed.
Mohammed. Oh, okay. Go ahead. Yeah.
I have a question about hydrangea, Anomala petiolaris, a climbing hydrangea. It's about 16, 17 years old, and it's growing on an arbor. Small arbor. It has outgrown the arbor. I need to dig it up and move it. The question is, how severely can I prune it back? The main stems are about 1.5 inches in diameter, and when should I do that? And what I would like to do is transplant it to grow up a mature oak tree, but I want to make sure that unlike ivy, it will not hurt the tree.
Yeah, no, it's not going to hurt the tree for climbing hydrangeas. I think probably one of the things is I would probably try and cut it back the least amount as you possibly can in order to move it, to be honest with you. And it will probably pout,
right.
I would imagine, that first year. They're one of those that has, and I don't know if you noticed it before, but they have a tendency to be really slow to get established.
Yes, it was.
They kind of mope around, and I think they're putting down a lot of roots, and they don't do a lot of top growth. You know, don't be surprised if this year it kind of mopes along and it is not all that terribly happy. And then just make sure that you keep it moist. But climbing hydrangeas are one of those vines that people just aren't terribly familiar with, but they're really beautiful plants, and they will take shade. So I think you're fine. I do it in the spring once things start to pop out a little bit.
Okay.
I go ahead and do that. You're probably looking at it first of April or so.
Maybe use some twine or something to help it get started up the oak tree.
Yeah, definitely if you want to go that route, you're going to have to probably, they kind of send out those little aerial rootlets.
Yes. So
they kind of attach themselves eventually, but yeah, you're probably going to have to do something to keep it up there to begin with, but
and I'm,
just keep it moist over the summertime. That's going to be the big thing, too.
I'm going to have to jump in here because we're at the end of the time, and I want to say thanks, Sandy, for being with us. Hope to see you now here next month, okay?
Yes, and we're going to be with Joe Lample.
Oh, all right. Well, special guest.
Yeah, this
very
will be
good.
Fun.
All right. Hey, thanks very much.
Sure.
Sandy Mason, horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County.